Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Lot to think about this hour. When breast cancer comes calling a second time, what does that mean to someone already in a higher risk population? And can religious tolerance be embodied in a sacred building? We'll have an update on the escalating tensions between Israel and Palestine, also the conflict between a search for justice and an attempt to reconcile religious and political conflicts in Northern Ireland puts a new spin on the notion of academic oral history at Boston College. We'll talk about that. But we begin with a two-part look at a crisis over the availability of water around the world.
The group of women say the municipality has failed them after numerous promises to supply them with water. Police moved in when the protesters started undressing. Residents have barricaded entrances to the village, preventing tankers from entering.
Sounds of anger there from across the globe, particularly in South Asia, and especially in America, where there is a water crisis that has only gotten worse since the beginning of 2014. And of course, you have a voice in all this.
Hi, my name's Daryl Willis. I'm from West Palm Beach, Florida. And I wanted to say, on this planet, in this age, clean water is unfortunately a privilege. It's not a matter of philosophy, it's just economics. Clean water is a commodity, whether or not we like that fact. And until such time as demand no longer outweighs supply, it will be treated and traded as such.
A widely held sentiment, but we want to know your view on all of this. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Is water a privilege or a political right? We'd love to hear from you. You can also post a comment at thetakeaway.org. A drought emergency in the state of California has been in place for months. According to the Government Accountability Office, even under normal water conditions, water managers in as many as 40 states are already anticipating serious water shortages over the next 10 years. In an attempt to stay out in front of this huge but slow-moving crisis, we've been carrying on a conversation over the past several months with expert David Sedlak, co-director of the Berkeley Water Center and author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. Welcome back to The Takeaway, David.
Thanks for having me, John.
So, David, let's talk just a little bit about where things stand in California. You hear Governor Brown talking about water every other day. He's now right in the center of this immigration crisis. It almost sounds like he's running for president, the old days of 1980. Anything reminiscent to you?
Oh, it definitely seems like old times are back again, and having Jerry Brown there makes it feel like the previous water crisis. But there's a difference this time, and that's that we have a lot more experience in how to deal with our water problems, and we have more technologies to try to come up with new ways of sourcing water that don't rely upon imported water.
What's the update that you would give us that's sort of a takeaway halfway through 2014, really 6 months after Jerry Brown declared this state of emergency in California, and we've seen similar impacts in other states in the American West?
Well, it's certainly still dry here in California, and the farmers are really struggling with the water availability and their low allocations of water from the state and federal water projects. But the good news is that the cities in California are feeling pretty confident in their ability to survive and keep going over the next few years.
What about institutional changes that would deal with tensions between agricultural users of water, which often have favorability over residential users of water? Those can be tense depending upon which state and locality you are in. How have you resolved that in the state of California, and what lessons are to be learned around the United States going forward?
John, I'm sorry to say that I don't think we've made a great deal of progress in our discussions about water rights and the need for water for agriculture, cities, and the environment. And so I think we're going to have to find other ways for cities to provide themselves with water, because the politics behind water transfers and water rights are complex and not easily resolved.
Have we ever asked the fundamental sort of civic question in the United States, whether water is a political right to a citizen of a country, or whether it constitutes some sort of commodity where it's a privilege if you live close to it, if you're smart enough to live close enough to it, if you're lucky enough to live close enough to it, that sort of thing?
I think we've done that in the courts, and we've done that in the political process. And to me, the question of right or privilege isn't the right one to be asking. It's really the fact that water is a necessity. And I think increasingly we're realizing that it's an economic necessity. That is, if cities want to continue to grow and have the kinds of be the kinds of places that people expect them to be, they need access to a secure source of water for the long term.
So water as a necessity, and trying to get this into some sort of political context, does politics sort of cloud that issue of necessity? Or how would you rank water in terms of the way that we deal constantly with issues like education in politics? A viable and vibrant educational system in a community is certainly a means for driving growth in that community. How can water be conveyed as a similar sort of driver of growth in a community?
Well, when businesses suspect that a city doesn't have a viable source of water in the long term, they're going to be hesitant to locate there and invest there. And so one has to think not only about water in a time of crisis, we have to think about the water supply on the timescale of decades, because that's really how long it takes to create a new water source or to make a conservation program really have the impact that we want it to have. And so if we're not serious about water, then the jobs that we want in our cities won't come there. And the ones that are there will think about other places to go where there's a more secure water supply.
And the disheartening takeaway there is that our political system is not really great at working on a long timescale like that. David Sedlak, co-director of the Berkeley Water Center and author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you, John.
We now go to a place surrounded by fresh water where there is a different kind of water crisis that is just as serious. In March, officials in the cash-strapped city of Detroit turned off the tap for about 15,000 residents with unpaid water bills, a move that got the attention of the United Nations, as we'll hear. Many Detroit residents believe water is a human right, but as the population shrinks and the city is hobbled by its own bankruptcy, Quinn Kleinfelder, senior news editor for WDET, says it's become less and less feasible for the city to maintain its crumbling infrastructure.
The city of Detroit provides water for most of southeastern Michigan, so millions upon millions of customers, many, many towns surrounding Detroit and far beyond, actually. And so it is a very significant issue, and they've talked at times about trying to create a regional water system that would take it away from the city of Detroit, kind of get it off its books. In the midst of the bankruptcy, they've talked about privatizing the water department. The city owes about $18 billion in long-term debt, about $5 billion of that concerns the water department. People have been worried about whether or not the rates could increase or not if, in fact, it was privatized. Some people say they could double or triple. So there's been a lot of fear over what could happen because of the water. But in the particular situation now where they've had these targeted shutoffs of water, it brings up one of the questions that has played in Detroit for literally decades now. And that is water a right or a privilege? And should you pay to have water that's drinkable, or should it just be provided because your population is so poor it can't afford to pay?
And the United Nations has even gotten involved here, and suddenly the issue is, are we going to use Detroit's water system, or are we going to have the prospect of people taking buckets down to the Detroit River and retrieving water, you know, like they do in some parts of Lagos in Nigeria?
Exactly. And then face dysentery or whatever else could happen. There have been city officials that said, you know, that's free if you want to do that. If you actually want something that's treated and processed, then you have to pay for that in some fashion. And there's hundreds of thousands of customers then, as we said, with the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department. And the department estimated as many as half of them were behind in the water bills. So they started targeting those that specifically were $150 or more behind or 2 months behind. And that resulted in as many as 80,000 notices that their water would be turned off immediately. They actually turned off about 15,000 customers. The surprising part of that was that within 2 days, according to the department, of those waters being shut off, customers paid the bills. They actually came back and found the money somewhere and were able to pay it. So it's this one quarter of that 15,000 that still remains and that has been, as you say, part of the United Nations even effort to try to get them turned back on. They appealed to the UN, which actually found that Detroit turning off water to its customers violated international protocols that are supposed to support human rights. The UN did say that if you had the money to pay and you weren't, then that really didn't count. But if you were too poor to pay, then you were denying them a basic human right by turning off this water. It's become a larger issue, even than the UN to an extent, has become a political football in the ongoing congressional campaigns. Recently, Detroit Democratic Congressman John Conyers, the longest serving member of Congress that's looking for re-election, came out and joined some activists to say that, in fact, this was something that was going to hurt not only Detroit, but if you extend it with people throughout the country being behind in bills, it could hurt perhaps the entire nation.
This affects everybody. This is not selective or area-wide. When you're out of water, you're out of water.
You're out of water.
When you're out of water,
you're out of water.
Michigan Democratic Congressman John Conyers there. It sounds like a bit of a campaign rally there, talking about this water issue. In Detroit's particular circumstance, how come there's an open discussion of regionalizing the water system when there's never really been a serious discussion of regionalizing the tax base in Detroit, which might actually be a solution to the bankruptcy question?
Well, because the fact is that it is such a key component of the ongoing bankruptcy proceedings. The city has $5 billion worth of the debt somewhat related to the water department itself, and they need to get out from under that. They want to in some fashion. There have been those that are activists in the city who claim that the water shutoffs are just kind of a first salvo in an effort by the city to force people out of their homes at the moment. Some of the outer-lying areas of Detroit can have maybe a couple of occupied homes on a block surrounded by 10, 12 that are abandoned or blighted. The city's trying to tear those down, but it's going to be a multi-year effort and a multi-million, billion-dollar effort to do that. So the city is trying to marshal its resources more towards the areas that are more populated in Detroit. And that means you've got some people out there, one or two houses that people have kept up for 40 years, waiting for the city to come back, that suddenly may not have the city come back around it. So city officials have said, we're going to at some point turn off the water service to those areas because we simply can't afford to send that much resources out to just one or two people. If those people are still out there, though, what becomes of them? And in fact, I talked to the deputy director of the department who said, when I asked him, is water a right or a privilege, he said he actually thought water was a right. But at the same time, he also said that if everybody takes that stand and nobody pays for it, then there's no way to get water to anybody else. And therefore, if you want to have water, someone's got to pay for it.
Quinn Kleinfelder, senior news editor for WDET in Detroit. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Whether you get your water from the fresh Great Lakes or not across America, what do you think? Should access to clean water be a right or a privilege? From New York City, one of you says what's happening in Detroit is unacceptable.
Access to clean water is a right. Otherwise, it becomes a judgment call made by the haves as to who deserves to live and who to die. Given our wealth and our technology, that's an unacceptable call.
Josh, Lake Grove, Oregon, says it's simple. No one owns water. You can't put a price on air, and you can't put a price on water. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Palestinian sources say more than 60 people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. At the same time, militants in Gaza continue to fire rockets into Israel, with sirens sounding on both sides of the border. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says the situation is on a knife edge, and Israel says Hamas is using Palestinians as human shields. Ron Prosser is Israeli ambassador to the United Nations.
Israel is using precision strikes to avoid harming civilians, but Hamas is exploiting our concern for human life by hiding in Palestinian homes, schools, and mosques, and using a Palestinian hospital as the headquarters.
But Palestinians say Israel is trying to keep Hamas's new alliance with the Palestinian National Authority from giving it any political credibility. We want to turn to Palestinian journalist Daoud Kattab on the ground in Jerusalem. Daoud, welcome.
Thank you very much, John.
So where do things stand right now? We have sort of outwardly escalating tensions, and these are always details that one can monitor one way or another between Israel and Palestinians. But given the regional situation right now, how do you see things that are going on?
The region is obviously in turmoil, but this doesn't change really
what is happening, which is an attempt by the Israelis to crush Hamas and to really destroy the attempts to have a unity government between the PLO and Hamas.
Do you think that the Israeli government sees the regional instability as an opportunity to try to separate Hamas and the coalition in the West Bank?
I think the Israelis are very happy with what happened in Egypt in regards to the Muslim Brotherhood. And they realize that Hamas doesn't have a lot of countries backing it up and guaranteeing any kind of statements. So, yes, I think that's part of the reason why the Israelis are taking such a tough stand against Hamas. But I think it's also very much internal, as always, Israeli policies are. You know, Avigdor Lieberman is pushing hard on Netanyahu, and he has to kind of prove that he's a tough cookie. And so we're actually suffering because some kind of internal feud between Israeli politicians.
Netanyahu's spokesman told us this week that the Israeli government views Hamas as identical to ISIS and Boko Haram in Nigeria. And we spoke with Palestinian commentators who describe this as ridiculous. How do you see it? And if Hamas was to showcase to the world that it is distinctly different from these groups and is much more of an actual nation builder as opposed to purely a terrorist group, what argument do you think Hamas would use?
Well, Hamas is in a region that is under occupation, under a military foreign occupation. And their emphasis is on ridding Palestinians of this Israeli occupation. They're not involved in any attacks against individuals outside of the region. They're not doing anything against anybody except the Israelis who are occupying Palestinian land. And any process that would allow us, whether John Kerry move, Martin Indyk, or anybody else can help us end this occupation, we will make any offer to the Israelis that will help them be sure that they will be secure and safe. Even today, as the Israelis are pounding Gaza, the Palestinian leadership are refusing to end the coordination, security coordination with Israel. The security coordination that Abbas has with Israel gets him a lot of attacks on social media, in public arenas, and yet he's still holding on to coordination with Israel because he believes in a political, nonviolent solution. I think the Israelis are really totally wrong in not granting Mahmoud Abbas the kind of relationship that they need. They will not find a better leader on Palestinians that understands the need for a nonviolent political solution. I think the Palestinians are willing to go back to the talks as soon as possible, as long as the Israelis are committed to seriously ending the conflict.
Daoud Kitab, Palestinian journalist and columnist for Al Monitor. He spoke with us from Jerusalem. Daoud, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Take care. Bye-bye.
The pair of words Good Friday, the Friday before Easter, means this to the people in the UK and Ireland.
The idea that if one side wins something in Northern Ireland, the other loses, is gone. The essence of what we have agreed is a choice. We are all winners or all losers. It is mutually assured benefit or mutually assured destruction.
In 1998, Prime Minister Tony Blair's words signifying the Good Friday Agreement ended 30 years of sectarian strife in Northern Ireland. A milestone of settled history, but a controversy over an oral history project at Boston College is now threatening to unravel that history. Boston College's attempt to document the historical truth of the unrest in Northern Ireland went awry in May of this year when police seized some of the archive and used its contents as grounds to arrest Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams in connection with a murder dating back to 1972. Adams was released from British authorities without charge, but not without raising questions about academic freedoms and whether old hatreds can ever really be put to rest. Boston Globe columnist Kevin Cullen has been talking to former IRA veterans for his latest piece for the paper. Kevin, welcome.
Thanks, John.
And Boston College spokesman Jack Dunn, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Jack, how did this oral history project evolve originally? What was its intent?
Sure. After the Good Friday Agreement was signed in 1998, a scholar from Ireland approached Boston College and said it would be a great idea to record the histories of people who had been involved in the Troubles. Boston College's Burns Library is internationally acclaimed as the leading repository of materials Irish. And after the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, there was a general consensus in Northern Ireland that people wanted to move away from the tumultuous past, away from the divide, and embrace peace and reconciliation, and that this project would go to great lengths in furthering that sense of peace and reconciliation that emerged after the Good Friday Agreement.
And part of that sense of reconciliation is that we think of this somehow as settled history. Kevin, how did that fit with those you spoke with on the ground in Belfast?
What I tried to accomplish on the ground in Belfast was not to beat up BC. I guess BC could be accused of maybe naivete at this point, but I think that the genesis of the idea, the project, I think was very valid. And the one thing I must say, coming back from Belfast, having talked to the people that gave these disputed interviews, they feel a bit estranged from the whole Republican movement. These are guys who, you know, spent many, many years in prison, who did things that they're not necessarily proud of now looking back. They committed acts of violence, and while they believe they were justified in committing those acts of violence, they think that there was a bit of folly to the whole idea of the war that they launched and the war that they carried out for the Irish Republican Army. And they believe that their histories, if not for this project, would never be told, would never be recorded, because they are sort of outside the mainstream Republican movement. They are not part of Sinn Féin. They are not on good terms with the Sinn Féin leadership, and they feel that Sinn Féin is trying to control the narrative, the, how history will be told. And that's the real subplot I picked up on the ground in Northern Ireland, that this is as much a struggle, not over just an archive, but a struggle over who gets to tell the story of what happened in what the Irish, in their penchant for understatement, call the Troubles.
Now, what is your understanding of how Northern Ireland police and, I guess, essentially British authorities got a hold of some of this testimony and turned it into a prosecution leader that motivated the arrest and questioning of Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams?
Well, I mean, it was in Ed Maloney's book that was published several years ago. That's when they would have found out about it. I mean, I'm a columnist, so I am paid to engage in opinion. And my opinion from the beginning has been that this was a cynical exercise by the police in Northern Ireland, ostensibly going after these records, going after academic research, was on the basis that it contained information about the murder of Jean McConville in 1972, one of the most horrific crimes ever committed in the Troubles. She was a widowed mother of 10. She was dragged from her house by an IRA gang. With her children literally clinging to her legs, she was abducted, she was murdered, and she was secretly buried. Now, as I've written before over the years, it's very interesting that with all the things that were in the BC archive, the only thing that the police were interested in was something that happened to implicate the leader of the largest nationalist party in Northern Ireland. That is political on its nature. Now, the other part of this is that, you know, the British authorities requested this information under a treaty that the U.S. and U.K. had signed. And there's clearly exemptions for political issues in this treaty. And this prosecution in the McConville case, all of these prosecutions that could arise out of these stuff that was done by the BC Oral History Project, they are by their nature political. They are political offenses, and everybody, I think, would acknowledge that. But now the police have said they want the entire archive. And from the beginning, it's always struck me as very unreasonable that an American institution of higher learning would be a proxy investigator for a foreign law enforcement agency. It makes no sense. And I think the police should have been told from the very beginning, you're going after political stuff. The American government invested untold political capital. George Mitchell spent 5 years of his life over there. And this thing that the police are trying to do over there is in direct violation, contradicts American foreign policy for the last 20 years. It makes no sense to me.
So what are the lessons of all this? Jack, what's the takeaway here? The U.S. and the U.K. have what's called a Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, an MLAT agreement, as it does with many countries, something that's meant to be of mutual benefit. In reality, how does that play after all you've been through at Boston College?
The takeaway is that people will be reluctant to conduct oral history projects in those countries that have MLAT obligations with the United States. Once again, the MLAT treaty was in existence in 1996, and it was that treaty that the PSNI, Police Services of Northern Ireland, invoked in getting the Department of Justice to issue the subpoenas to Boston College.
And Kevin, your takeaway?
Well, my takeaway, like I said, the purpose of my story was not really to rehash a lot of these issues. It was really to go on and get on the ground in Belfast and get a sense of what is going on. And my takeaway is that this is sort of a microcosm of the trouble in Ireland of reconciling the past, of dealing with it. They do not have an official truth and reconciliation process such as we saw in South Africa. So they're doing it piecemeal. The armed struggle has been replaced with a legacy struggle. And people that fought the war, they want to tell their version of it. And again, I think that is a valuable contribution to our understanding of what happened during the Troubles.
Kevin Cullen, Boston Globe columnist, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to Boston College spokesman Jack Dunn. Thank you very much, Jack.
Thanks for having us, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Our new friend at The Takeaway, Anita Coleman, doesn't hesitate when you ask her what described her best about 6 months ago.
I was happy. Genuinely happy. You know, I guess I'm always have a smile on my face. People can tell when something's wrong because there's no smile.
And for a little while, but just for a little while, you would have known that Anita, grandma of three, living in L.A., was going through a bit of a rough time last February.
Stage 2 breast cancer. I had two types of tumors, one positive receptor, one negative. The first time, out of 16 lymph nodes, 14 of them were cancerous. This time, I believe out of 16 lymph nodes, only two of them were cancerous.
Anita Coleman is our third voice in a series we began this week about three black women coping with breast cancer and dealing with the uneasy statistics that African-American women are significantly more vulnerable than white women to the disease. Under Her Skin, Living with Breast Cancer is our way of getting beyond the numbers and letting real people tell their stories. Anita Coleman talked to us as a veteran of breast cancer. This is her second diagnosis. A good friend to have if you have questions about a disease that kills 40,000 women in the U.S. per year.
Because of the aggressiveness of my first diagnosis, I had to go 10 years before I was in remission. In 2011, I made my 10 years, and I was like, okay. But they had always told me that it could be dormant.
So what happened in February of 2014?
In February 2014, I went for my annual mammogram, and my primary care physician called me, and he said, your mammogram looks suspicious. We want you to go to ultrasound. He said, it looks like, you know, you have cancer again. And I went for the ultrasound, and they did see two lumps, and my doctor scheduled me for a core-guided biopsy. I went for that, and his assistant called and said, the doctor wants to see you in his office. And I was actually coming out of a store because we were preparing for the party that I was giving that's going to say either I didn't have cancer again or I did. And I pulled over to the side, and he told me. And it was like, okay. I was upset for a minute, but 99% of you says the test is going to be negative. But there's that 1% that said, just in case, you better get ready. And at that point, I knew I had to get ready. So I did some crying there, went home, did some more crying, called a couple of my friends and family, let them do their crying. I said, okay, that's enough. That's it. Let's move on with this.
Is there any decision that you made the first time around that you wish you'd made now?
The first time around, I had asked them if I could have a double mastectomy, and they talked to me because at that time I was engaged, and they said I'm, you know, for relationships and for appearance. Now at this age and what I'm thinking about appearance, which doesn't mean as much to me now as it did then, and don't get me wrong, I always keep myself up, but if I had known then, I probably would have had the double mastectomy, but I can't just keep going back to what I should have done, because I could have had the double mastectomy and they still could have diagnosed me with another cancer. So I can't I can't beat myself up about that.
No. But you did that partly because of, the marriage that you were getting into, right?
Yeah, the marriage that, every woman wants to look equal. They want to look right.
Have you talked to your ex-husband about this?
No, that's my ex-fiance. He couldn't deal with the total strains of someone having cancer, so it didn't work.
Really?
Yeah.
So he just said, see you later, bye.
Yeah, pretty much. It got a little bit depressing while I was going through chemo and radiation, but I made it. I'm still here. And illness is hard to deal with because my experience with men, most of them can't deal with a cold too well. So, so what I have learned is everybody is different. Male and female alike. I have female friends who can't deal with the illness that well. My illness actually got them more depressed than it got me.
So what was it like to investigate your genetic history? Because you knew this had something maybe to do with a genetic past that as an adoptive child, you had to investigate like a detective.
The first time they asked me, did I want to get the paperwork that would help get my documents opened to find out about my biological mother's medical history? And I opted not to, because being adopted and knowing the story of my adoption from what my adoptive mom and what the paperwork has told me, my biological mother must have told some tales, lies, stories to her family. Because she was married and had two kids, so I don't know where she disappeared to while she had me. I don't know the history. But I chose not to disrupt the lives of people who had nothing to do with her lies. And my concern turned to my daughter and my future grandchildren at that point. The second time around, I had to take the genetic test. And so from that genetic test, since it says I am a carrier, my concern now is for my two children. My daughter has been tested, and my son has got to be tested.
So in our group of three African-American women who have been diagnosed, you're kind of the elder statesman here. Because you've been around the track twice.
I'm the veteran. I'm not the rookie.
That's right. How do you feel about the statistics on the outcomes for African-American women and the really scary probabilities compared with other populations?
When you're going through a health challenge like this, one of the key factors is to remain stress-free, to be in a safe environment, quiet environment. And I have been fortunate that the first time I didn't have to work. The second time, it was not my choice not to work because at the same day it was probable that I had cancer again. I was also told I was going to be laid off. But I looked at it as a blessing because I did have a stressful job. And God has made it possible. I'm not uncomfortable. I have food. My rent is paid. I don't have to worry about my medical bills because I had retired once. And so I have full medical coverage. And so many African-American women, they don't have the coverage that they need. And then some of them, I've met people. I know women who had cancer and chose not to have the treatment because they had to go to work to support their family. My whole thing is you don't have to have a lot of money to make it. There's a lot of people and a lot of groups out there that will help, but pride sometimes keeps people from asking for help. Our exercise, our health, our eating habits, we have to change those. And people don't like to change, but a lot of people going through cancer don't realize they have to exercise. With the education about the disease and the education about the recovery process, we have to be more proactive. And that's where African-American women have not been proactive because they're so busy taking care of their families. A lot has to change.
Anita Coleman, 54-year-old mother, diagnosed with breast cancer in February of 2014. She successfully fought the disease once before in 2001. To hear an extended version of our conversation and to listen to her audio diary, visit us at thetakeaway.org/series/breastcancer. And we want to invite everyone to take part in this exploration of breast cancer, especially African-American women. What's it like to live with the disease? We've started a Facebook group. We'd love for you to join. Go to Facebook.com and type in Under Her Skin to find us. You can share your stories, post pictures, take part in our ongoing conversation about the trials and triumphs of living with breast cancer. Again, join our group by typing in the phrase Under Her Skin on Facebook. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.